Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Welcome, everybody. In today's episode, we'll be going back in time to high school freshman year English class to focus in on the 1966 film adaptation of Ray Bradbury's science fiction political drama of Fahrenheit 451.
Maybe, unlike me, you did not first experience this book in high school, or maybe not even in school at all. Most people have either read the story or know the basic plot. A society that is focused on technology has outlawed books and any written media. If books are found, the person is arrested and the books are burned.
In today's episode, we're going to compare the movie and the book.
In the movie, Montag, played by Oscar Werner, is a fireman whose job it is to find and burn outlawed books. After meeting a young woman, Clarice, played by Julie Christie, he starts collecting, reading, and hiding the outlawed books in his house. He is suspected by his boss, played by Cyril Cusack, who gives him a warning, but after his wife Linda, also played by Julie Christie, turns him in, Montag murders his boss, runs away with a book, is chased by law enforcement, and is rescued by a group of intellectuals who have all memorized a different book. The movie ends with all the intellectuals at camp memorizing their book and passing their knowledge to one another. While this is very similar to the book, there are some key points and key plot points missing.
Or changed.
Like, the first one is Clarice in the book is 17 and dies in a house fire, but Clarice is aged up a little bit and given this pseudo-romantic line with Montag.
Yes, Clarice is aged up because Julie Christie is playing her, and she's also given a much more significant role, where in the book, from what I remember, is fairly small at the beginning, and she's just the impetus to have him start to question his life and what he's doing.
Another thing that has changed is his wife in the book is named Mildred, and in the movie, he is Linda. Linda was a common name in 1966, but also the most common name when the book came out in 1951. In my opinion, I think they changed it to Linda because Linda sounds like it could be anybody. It's a very common name. It's very timeless. And Mildred kind of gives this 1950s housewife feel.
Yeah, and I think also part of that is if they're not happy with the name, they'll just quickly change it to something that they feel just better fits the screenplay or the direction they're going. One of the more famous examples is in The Searchers, John Wayne plays a character named Ethan. In the book, his name is Amos. That happens quite a lot when books are rewritten into movies. Either they combine character names or they just change characters' names altogether.
Another thing that is different about the movie is that a very important character never shows up in this movie. Professor Faber is not in the movie. He may be allusioned to as Clarice's unseen uncle or even Clarice's new character because Clarice is a teacher and Professor Faber is a teacher.
For me, it's very obvious. They combine the two characters. She's a teacher. She's the one that gives him the impetus at the beginning, like the Clarice in the book. But she also is the one that starts giving him and teaching him what a good life is and hints at where he should be going, which is what Professor Faber does in the book. And I think it's actually a technical reason for the film because it's really hard to introduce a character in the second half of a film. If you don't introduce a character, an important character at the in the beginning, and you introduce an important character at the second half of the film, audiences usually get lost on why that character is so important. So I think they just, instead of trying to figure out a way to either introduce Faber early, they just decided that, you know what, we're going to combine the Clarice and Faber characters together, which makes a lot more sense.
They also take away the political aspect of this movie a lot. You know, with Professor Faber's character, Professor Faber talks about how it's people like him who are to blame for society now and the book burnings because they didn't do anything when they had an opportunity to do so. There's also not a huge mention of war, which is an imminent force within the book. No mention of war and not the pending nuclear war, which I think is because in 1966, plot lines in movies about nuclear war were kind of commonplace and boring. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would say that it wasn't as shocking. When he wrote the book in 1953, there's only 8 years. We actually started writing in 1951, and then it finally got published in 1953, if I remember correctly. And so you're only a few years removed from Hiroshima and the Nagasaki atomic bombs. You're only really 2-3 years removed from Russia obtaining the nuclear weapon, the atomic bomb. So the threat, the nerves, everything was hanging in the air, so, which is why it kind of was weaved into his story. By 1966, you're in the middle of the Cold War. There's a lot more at stake. It's still there. But even Ray Bradbury felt that it wasn't as overwhelming a thing. So he actually advised not to put it in the movie, that to move on from that storyline. The problem that I had is that at that point, though, is just like, what is, besides a pretty young woman asking him, why is he doing what he's doing? What was the impetus for him to change and start to re-examine the book burning? Because in the book, his impetus is he's dissatisfied with the fact that the world is on the brink of war, and is what he's doing really helping the cause? Is it really?
Yeah, people are choosing to ignore it and just watch boring television so they can forget their dream, could forget what's happening in real life.
Yeah, and of course, there's no mention of it in the media. All the shows are very superficial. There's nothing. In fact, they keep talking about, what did you watch today? And his wife can't remember what she watched in the book. So, and then when you watch the show in the movie, it's a very superficial show, and it just drives home the fact that nothing that she is doing with the TV and the clamshell, what they call it, the clamshell radios, which we would, in today's world, think of as Walkman, which would eventually become MP3 players in our world, or phones or whatever, with people walking around with these devices. So,
and earphones and things like that.
Yeah, with earphones and things like that. So it's not like the technology that's in this movie and the book is something that's so far-fetched that we would be going, wow, that's really fantastic. It's all stuff that we would really know about. So
the last thing that I want to talk about one of the major changes in from the book to the movie, is that they changed Montag's book from the Book of Ecclesiastes to a book of poetry from Edgar Allan Poe.
Why do you think they did that?
Probably because they didn't have enough time to talk about the religious aspects. But I think it also adds a little bit more emphasis on the human side of the books, because Montag in the movie says, there's a man behind each book, that's what I'm interested in. And if you pick a religious text, it's not, there's no human behind it, you know? It's a very religious story, and there's gods and saints and things, which we can't relate to. But if you pick...
It's a book written by Edgar Allan Poe,
which is a common author with everybody.
He's basically picking a book to be the man that he wants to know about. One of the things, too, that I think why they changed it is because I think visually you started to see that one of the shots of things being burned, there's like a Mad Magazine in there. So it's like they're showing you that every printed document and magazine and book has become so precious because they're all getting burned. By taking out the Bible and switching it, They're just showing you that every book is important. They didn't want Montag's book to outweigh everybody else's book. They're talking about how all these books are equally important because all the knowledge is being lost because of the burning. So for me, when I watch the movie, that's what I see. I see them trying to show you that it's not what's in the book. It's the fact that people are burning and getting rid of knowledge and ideas. That's the big issue. All right. So this is the big question. So we just pointed out some differences, and there's always going to be differences when you make adaptations from books into movies, because let's face it, they're two different mediums. They have two different things. One of them, books, deal with the internal, and one of them, movies, deals a lot with external. And so do you think this adaptation works? And what do you like about it? What do you not like about it? Overall, it's like anything that you adapt. There's going to be some things that are going to be sticking points for you, and there's some things that you understand why they did that in the movie. So let's start off with generally, how do you think the adaptation went?
I think the adaptation for it being a book movie has done a lot better of a job keeping its plot together than some other movies that I know of. It has the main points. It follows the main points. It's a movie adaptation of a book.
Well,
there's a difference between being like, oh, it adds something new and it was amazing. Oh, it's an adaptation of of my favorite book, versus, okay, I rewatched this, and looking back on it, it's an adaptation of a book. I think part of the reason why I remember liking it so much when I was in freshman year of high school is because we watched it in class. So, of course, in class there's other distractions, but we also watched it as like a reward for finishing the book. So I already had all the fresh information in my head about the book. So I knew what the plot is and what this character meant and what this character means by them saying this line at this time. So I probably read a lot more into it. What I really like about this adaptation, though, that being said, is I like the colors. I think it's very colorful. In the book, I always pictured things being dark and dreary. And I kind of like the fact that it was like that everything was very colorful. It was very everyday-esque, because it kind of makes it feel a little bit more imminent if it feels like this thing could happen every day.
Yeah, I think it's one thing when you talk about dystopian futures or dystopian societies and stories, what usually goes into that in that design is that it's dark, it's dreary, things are breaking down, things don't work. And in this society, no, things work. They're driving around in their fire trucks. People are driving around in their car and riding bicycles. People live in houses. There's a public transportation system. They're traveling around. There's even EMTs that come and deal with a medical emergency. So I like that part of a dystopia. We're usually force-fed such a dark version of the society that here the dystopia is not because everything's falling apart. This dystopia is because actually how society is working or not working in this case. So that's one thing I liked about this adaptation. I did like the fact that it was bright, it was colorful. Like you said, it also had that thing where people just did things as a matter of fact. They didn't act like it was shocking that they were doing what they were doing. People were happy that they were burning books.
Multiple things that I did not enjoy about this adaptation. One of the things is cannot be helped is the stunted lines. They're not very poetic. Not saying that Ray Bradbury is a poetic author, but the lines felt very stunted. Didn't add a lot of emotion to the movie.
So I've watched movies with a lot of dialogue that isn't, it's very utilitarian, because that's the way that the movie is designed, because that's what they're showing is a society that, how do you talk and communicate in a very poetic manner when everything that would teach you how to talk that way is being taken away from you? The way that people communicate is usually in the movie is fairly direct, very brutal. there isn't a whole lot of innuendo or hidden meanings, because the things that would teach people how to do that have been taken away, the books. So there's two things that they had problems with the delivery of the lines, is that Julie Christie delivered the lines the same way as Clarice, the young teacher, and as Linda, his wife. And only at the very end, when Linda decides to turn him in, go against Montag, does her delivery actually change. And number two is that Oscar Werner, I know it's not his first language, English is not his first language, but his delivery of some of the lines were so flat that it was just like, okay, it haven't really established that people are taking sedatives and amphetamines and stuff like that, which is in the book. People take, you know, sleeping pills or take energy pills, depending on what they need to do. If you're gonna deliver lines that flat, there has to be a reason for it. So I felt the two leads had issues in their delivery. And that for me was like, ow. Sometimes it made some very awkward line readings.
Well, one of the things that you say about that, one of the lines that one quote from a Time critic in 1966 says that this movie strongly supports the widely held suspicion that Julie Christie cannot act. Though she plays two women of drastically divergent dispositions, they seem in her portrayal to differ only in hairdos. And I think,
I think it's a little harsh, but yeah, I can see that. But also, part of my thing is that's kind of also how the society is. Everybody kind of starts, everybody's acting very similar. So that might have actually been her direction. You see that all the firemen kind of react the same way until Montag starts to break away from them and start doing things differently, and they all question him, but with their looks and their body language. There is a lot of uniformity in this movie about different people acting in and mirroring each other. So maybe that was the direction she was given. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't particularly enjoy the two leads' acting ability in this movie as well. Another thing that I don't particularly enjoy of this production is that, again, Julie Christie plays two characters, and not because of her acting ability, but because it doesn't fit. You know, it doesn't fit. Like, Clarice is a 17-year-old, wide-eyed, optimistic, and Mildred in the book, Linda in the movie, yes, they are foils of each other, but do they necessarily need to be hit over the head with their foilness?
So for me, the two characters are a mirror of each other. You have Linda slash Mildred later in life, who is trying to not be involved in life, is drinking, watching TV, taking sleeping pills, and not interacting with life at all. She doesn't even really go out of the house. And then you have Clarice being much younger, who is asking questions, trying to be part of society. And people tend to forget that the part of the book that Ray Bradbury is doing is he's actually commenting on society. And one of the big comments that he has in the society is, once the people got older and comfortable, they were totally cool with all the changes. They didn't want to deal with or fight or lose what their perceived life that they had earned. So when the major changes happened, they let it happen to the point where by the time they realized what happened, they couldn't stop it, which is in the book, the Dr. Faber character tells Montag. And in the movie, it's alluded to with the woman, the older woman who decides to burn up with her books and go out with her books. So in their casting, were they trying to just visually tell you that they were mirror characters? I think that's kind of clunky. We have mirror characters all the time in film, in books, and we don't cast the same people. We don't even have them talk the same way. And sometimes they're different genders or different, they happen at different times. It's just, you know, that a mirror character does not have to be that obvious a mirror character. I found that kind of a weird choice.
So One of the things that I want to mention before I ask you the same question is that I also really, with his artistic ability as a, this is his like third movie that he did or something like that, with his artistic ability, the director, Francois Truffaut, I thought it was a very interesting take that he did where he made all of the credits a voiceover.
Well, yeah, he's drawing you into this world from the very beginning. Once the Universal logo goes away, it's literally you're in that world. And they're reading you the credits. They're showing you all the different TV antennas that are spread through the city. So you know how the society is structured at the very beginning. He's visually telling you before that you even see the main character, before you see what's going on, exactly what's happening. And then you see the fire truck come up and you're thinking, oh, there's a fire truck. It's a different looking fire truck, but it's red. It has firemen on it. You think, okay, this is a fire truck of the future. And then, of course, the firemen burn books instead of put out fires. Another thing that in the book, the reason why it's a little bit more drawn into the firemen thing is they actually don't just pull out the books out of the house and then burn them on the street like they do in the movie. They burn the house and the books down together. It's like a full-on thing. So it's tied a little bit more together and why they're called firemen.
Just a question. This might be a more of a philosophical question than anything, but do you think it's very interesting, or an artistic question, I mean, do you think it's very interesting that the first book that we see as an audience in this entire film is Don Quixote?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a choice. The author was persecuted. He wrote the book while imprisoned, and this boy is going way back on some of my English classes. There's a lot more politics in Don Quixote they're definitely telling you that this is going to be a layered story, and there's definitely some things that are referenced there. There's also, you see like certain books that are being burned, you see their titles, and a lot of those books that are being burned are, there's always like, what I liked about it is there's always a philosophy book in there, or a book that we would just sit there and go, wait a minute, why are we saving that? Why do we want to save that book? Like later on, when they find a secret stash, the secret library, one of the books they grab is Mein Kampf from Adolf Hitler. It's like, why would you save that book? But when you're in a society that's burning everything, everything printed becomes precious.
Well, I also thought that it was very interesting that they pick Don Quixote is that it fits for both themes or both people sides of the argument. A wonderful book. It's about persecution and has a deeper meaning and things like that. But also the main character goes insane because of reading.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of the main point of this whole political argument.
The political argument that was made in this society was some things written upset people. Some people were not emotionally mature enough to handle what was written to withstand the things that upset them, which I think actually in today's world, where you see that a lot, where people say things on social media or they say things in the news and the people lash out saying, how dare you say that? I'm not saying whatever that you're mad at is correct or not correct, but you should have enough emotional maturity to know that what they're saying is wrong. You don't have to sit there and lash out at them angrily over it. What you can do is use it as a teaching moment in your life with other people and say, this is what should have been said, or what, this is not the way you should be communicating. And having that dialogue versus just shutting people down. And so basically what the society is that there's too much volatile information out there. We're just going to shut it down. But they're flooding society with images and through television or their newspapers have printed pictures. And there's a few little pamphlets and stuff like that that are all printed with pictures and things like that in the movie. And in the book, I don't remember. But honestly, it's like they're flooding you with these another form of communication that wipes out what people's need to read.
I think it's actually different than that. I think they take away all of the information and they don't Well, maybe this is what you're saying, and I'm just getting it wrong. They don't add any more information to the world like Brave New World and Brave New World and 1984. They take away all information, but give everybody this one narrative.
So, we've been talking about the adaptation, whether or not you liked it or didn't like it, and what some of the issues were. Do you think that this movie did the book justice? And we can argue and nitpick about what made a good adaptation and what makes a bad adaptation. But do you think the book was served correctly by this movie?
I think that this movie almost did justice to this book. I think it's a little too watered down, in my opinion, to give true justice to this book. They had great points and they had great strong imagery, but along with some of the changes, it takes away from the great impact of this book. Do you believe that this movie did the book justice, Dad?
Yeah, so no, I don't. Honestly, the more and more I think about the book in my head, this might be nostalgia because I didn't reread the book before watching the movie. I probably should have. It's a very short novel. But what I remember from the book and questions it asks, I felt that the book did a really good job of asking some questions in a sci-fi format. The movie felt stagey, felt staged. And although it wasn't as bad as some book adaptations that I've seen where it literally is like there's two different versions where they grab the title of the book, they write the title on the front page, and then they throw the book away and they come up with whatever plot that they want, which it was not nearly as bad as that because it pretty much is, like we've already discussed, the plot of the book with some major and minor changes. Or what there is, which is even, I find even worse for adaptations of books, is where it's almost like what I call postcard movie, where it's like there's a postcard scene from chapter one. This is what everybody remembers chapter one because it's so famous. And then there's a postcard scene from like chapter five where remember that scene in the book that everybody talks about? It's there for you. And then there's a postcard scene of what happens in. And by the end, this is the famous ending that everybody talks about. Here's the postcard scene. It's shot just like the book. So it feels kind of dead because it's scenes strung together. It didn't go down those two rabbit holes. But the problem that you said, it was kind of watered down. They didn't, some of the main reasons why this character would do what he wanted to do that was in the book were kind of, I don't know if I'm going to say mushy in the book.
Well, I didn't feel like he had just cause to all of a sudden change his whole life philosophy.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's like you meet a woman on the train and all of a sudden she asks you one question and then all of a sudden your whole world changes. And it changes a lot. Like he goes from having one book to 70 books in, I think, what, 15 minutes? And I'm not saying 15 minutes of screen time. I'm saying it seems like it's 15 minutes of his life in the movie. So it's like
one day he shows up and he steals a book and he's like, ooh, I'm a criminal. And then it turns out that he's been a criminal. It feels very off-putting, in my opinion.
But there are scenes in the movie that are just fantastic. Like the scene where Linda overdoses on sleeping pills and the EMTs come and revive her. That scene is done really well. And you when they just talk about the fact that she wasn't the first one that night that overdosed, and she's not going to be the last one, you realize that the society has accepted the fact that there's going to be a certain number of overdoses. B, they have a system in place to deal with the overdoses. And instead of trying to change it, they're just going to accept it and say, nope, we're happy with the fact that a number of people are going to die and overdose and survive. And this is just the way our society is built right now. We're going to accept that as part of the payment for this society that we have agreed to live in.
What makes that scene a really great scene and not a postcard scene?
Because of the way it's integrated into the film. When I say it's a postcard scene, it's like, you can see that the director lined up the shot and filmed it, the scene in and of itself. It's not part of the overall structure of the film. A long time ago, I think it was Jack Lemmon in an interview was talking about scenes are like pearls on a pearl necklace. It might be the most gorgeous pearl ever, but if it doesn't fit in the necklace, it doesn't serve its purpose. And that's what I talk about postcard movies. It's like there are a bunch of pearls. They might be, the scenes might be perfect, but they don't actually link up, and they don't fit in the line that they're supposed to fit in. Where that scene, you see him coming home where he's feeling somewhat happy, and then, of course, his wife is overdosed, and then it's like the horror of that, and how that part moves him forward. In the movie, that's the only justification I have found for him to move forward on his book reading, and because he's dissatisfied in his life and she can't remember it because of the whatever they do to revive her. She has no memory of that night. And
I think she does. I think she just chooses to not deal with the horrible things of life, which is one of the reasons why there's an attempted suicide.
Well, you view it as an attempted suicide. I view it as more of the fact that she sits at home, she drinks, she watches TV, and she pops pills, and it was more accidental. That's where you and I disagree, and we've disagreed on this before when we were discussing it. So that's fine. I view it more as it's accidental, and that the society is totally comfortable with the fact that either people are going to intentionally do this or accidentally do this, and we're just going to build a system of EMTs that are going to run around every house and revive these people. But there's in the book, the way it's described is a lot more, it's almost like a horror thing of how they revive her. And in the movie, it's very cold and calculated and very medical. You don't really see it, but.
I wanted to add this thing about postcards. Just popped in my head. The reason why they are called postcard scenes is because it feels like you're taking a vacation from the given narrative. Because yeah. There's a given narrative, and then all of a sudden, you're in a different island. You're in Hawaii version of this.
But and for me, what happens sometimes when films are adapted from books or from television shows or video games or some other property, there's these scenes. Sometimes the entire film is built this way, which is really annoying. There's these scenes that are like we're paying it for the fans. Do you think it's ironic that the book about the watering down of knowledge is been made as a movie that waters down its source material?
I think it was hilarious freshman year when we were reading this that part of our homework was like our teacher would send us like the Spark Notes quizzes.
Yeah.
You know, Spark Notes, no offense to Spark Notes because Spark Notes is an amazing thing. It's a very useful thing. But Spark Notes, its whole job is to narrow down into entertainment, into especially novels, to its like basic three act points. And I just think that was really hilarious that an English teacher teaching this book would give Spark Notes out as homework. I think making a movie about a dystopian future, about people making movies, is kind of ironic. I also think it's kind of ironic that Francois Truffaut got in trouble with the Cannes Theater because he was saying that all the movies that they were giving awards to were soulless book adaptations, and this turns out to be a soulless book adaptation.
Like you said, it's a soulless adaptation of a book. I know that Ray Bradbury liked this adaptation, and quite frankly, some of his other stuff was turned into some bad vehicles, so this is one of the better versions of one of the stories. So that might be why it has a softer spot. And it's been reexamined over the years, reassessed. And I know that some people like it, and we're going to talk about that later, but I find it like I never went back and watched it when I was younger because it had this really murky reputation. So when we get to that, we'll talk about that more.
So what do you think makes a good film adaptation? Because we are in the world, and right now we are in the age of film movie adaptations. Film movie adaptations? Duh. we are in the world of book movie adaptations, and we can take two different beloved YA novel series and turn them into movies, and one of them is a beloved film series and one of them has had trouble staying afloat. So what in your opinion makes a great film adaptation? We did talk about postcard movies and things like that. So what to you makes a good film adaptation?
Well, there's two things I think makes a good film adaptation. I think that the filmmaker does a great job of keeping the spirit of the book in the movie. And then I think for another thing that makes a really good adaptation is not being afraid to cut a beloved character or combine two beloved characters if it serves the plot and the storytelling. A famous example is in Lord of the Rings, cutting Tom Bombadil at the beginning in the film adaptation. You have to be comfortable doing that. But still, that movie had the spirit of the books in it. So,
well, that's what I was talking about with young A novel movies. Is one of the biggest movie adaptations in the world is Harry Potter, and to follow suit, Disney wanted to do that exact same thing with their beloved Percy Jackson series. And I can make a broad statement in saying that both of those series had a lot of overlap. But one of the reasons why everybody loves Harry Potter and couldn't stand Percy Jackson so much so that it killed the project halfway through its run is that, like you were saying, Harry Potter stays true to the book in the sense of it's keeping the themes alive, it's keeping the aesthetic alive, and it's keeping it had a through narrative, while Percy Jackson, not to be biased, took the book, ripped it up, chewed it, and pooped on a page and gave it to us. It was definitely a little chaotic, and it was definitely not true to the material, because the material is a sarcastic dude from New York, and what we got was Logan Lerman looking hot for 2 hours, which my 13-year-old self was fine with, but I was very, really annoyed as a fan of the books.
Well, I think if we're going to talk about those two different movie adaptations, we can do a whole different podcast on there. But one of the things I really want to point out is that both the first movie of Percy Jackson's was directed by Chris Columbus. The first two movies of Harry Potter were directed by Christopher Columbus. And the two weakest movies in the Harry Potter series were the first two. And I do not understand why they put Christopher Columbus in the beginning of Percy Jackson. He basically set out to make a Harry Potter clone. I think the one thing that really makes an adaptation really, really hard that people need to understand is that when you read a book, it's very internal. It's one-on-one. You're with the author. You're with the story. It's your interpretation. When the author writes the line, he walked into the village and there was a old brick building on the left-hand side. What you imagine in your head out from that line is your own imagination. Everybody is going to have a slightly different version of that. And what makes adaptation hard for film is that you as a director and a screenwriter and your production designer, everybody on that crew has to make a decision of what it really looks like. And you're only going to make maybe 60-75% of the people happy. What you really need to do is be comfortable with the fact that you're going to make these decisions and you're going to make the world as best as you can. And that's, I think, what people will understand that and they will accept that if they're watching a adaptation. They may not 100% agree with it. They would love it to be done differently. But what if you create the world and you create the overall impression and the spirit of the book is there, most people will accept it. Yeah, and let's face it, we love arguing about different points that aren't in the book, that are in the book, that aren't in the movie, and we will always do that. But generally speaking, when we start grading adaptations, what's the one thing that we always look at? How well does it capture the book?
A reporter once said that Fahrenheit 451 is an intriguing film that fuses Truffaut's trademark wit and black humor with the intelligence and morality of Ray Bradbury's novel. In 1966, critics called this movie dull, boring, pretentious, and pedantic, but over the years, this movie has grown in the eyes of film critics and filmmakers like Martin Scorsese. Do you think that this movie earns its renaissance, or do you think people look fondly because it is a Francois Truffaut film?
I do think there's some nostalgia for the film. I do think that people who went to film school or taught film school in the 60s and 70s, they look at Truffaut's career and they are champions of his work. And there are films he's done that are amazing, and there are films like this where I feel like he kind of missed the mark.
There is a bunch of, and Francois Truffaut in his autobiography or his diaries about filmmaking, he does depict the amazing amount of strife that had to go into this film. You know, he started the process in 1960. Takes him 6 years to make this film. At first, Paul Newman, he was going to be Montag, and they were going to film in New York in English. And then he fell through, so he moved on to two different French actors that he was going to film in France, in French, his native language. Then they fell out, and so then it was going to be Peter Toole back in England in English. Then it was going to be Terrence Stamp because Peter O'Toole fell out in English. And then finally, after all of this stuff, Oscar Werner in English in England was the final product. But Oscar Werner and Francois Truffaut didn't get along particularly well. And if you do watch this film, I suggest playing an Easter egg hunt where you can see where Oscar Werner shaved a patch of his own hair off because he wanted there to be a purposeful continuity error because he did not enjoy making this film with Francois Truffaut. And also, Francois Truffaut picked the ugliest hand model that he could find for Oscar Werner's hand model so that it looked like he had bad, gnarly hands as a punishment.
I watched that scene where he puts the tarp over himself, the hand pulls the tarp over himself. The hands weren't that ugly. I was kind of disappointed. I was kind of like, I read that too before we watched the movie, and I was like, oh, it's not that bad.
It's not that bad in our standards, but I bet you in 1966 standards, it's like the worst hands ever. You know how things go.
No, I think what it is he's just, they were being petty with each other. I think another thing that may be the reason why Oscar Werner is kind of flat in the movie. I don't know. I haven't watched a lot of movies where he's been the main character, or the main actor. So I don't know if that it's just his style too. I mean, I also know that they had a hard time getting Clarice cast. It was not going to be Julia Christie, so that may be one of the reasons why she played both parts, which I still think was a really weird decision. I don't know how hard it is to get another actress.
Well, even Ray Bradbury, who enjoyed this, said that the only mistake that they made was in the first one, meaning this one, was to cast Julie Christie as both the revolutionary and the bored wife. Right?
Yeah, and I think the thing was is it made the revolutionary a little bored and the bored wife a little bit more revolutionary because, as we talked about, she kind of played the characters the same. I think the thing is that troubled film, people, when films don't 100% work out they're received with mixed reviews and they have mixed reviews in history, people will always point to the troubled production and say, that's the reason why this film didn't work. And there are a lot of films that are famous, that are great, that have gone down in history as some of the best films made that had troubled production. So I don't sit there and point to those usually and say, that's the reason why that movie failed. What it does mean is that the movie had more to overcome to become a good movie or a great movie. But it doesn't give me, for me, it's not an excuse on why it ultimately wasn't a great movie.
Thank you so much for joining us in this episode about Fahrenheit 451. You can follow us on Twitter at TMLAJourney or on Instagram at TMLAJourneyThroughCinema. We also have a Facebook page under The Movie Log. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to review this on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
Next week, we'll be discussing a movie that we quite haven't decided yet, so it'll be a surprise for everyone.
Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed this episode.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.